From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and our top story today, the fate of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who was arrested yesterday at the Ecuadorian embassy in London after living there for nearly 7 years. Let's bring in Vaughn Smith via Skype. He's a friend of Assange and a freelance journalist. And Vaughn, I understand you visited Assange just a few days ago, and he knew his arrest was coming?
Well, the relationship with the Ecuadorians has gone south, really. And it really happened after the election, when Lenin Moreno became the president. He adopted a very different policy towards America, mainly. And this is perceived as America's will, that Julian is chucked out. But during the last year, it got very difficult for Julian. He lost his internet access. The surveillance on him in the embassy was doubled. There were two cameras in every room. And he was gagged. He wasn't allowed to speak to the press.
Well, to that point, the Ecuadorian president was apparently not so happy with Julian Assange as a house guest. He claimed that Assange had apparently attacked guards, that he may have accessed the embassy's security files. I mean, do you think that Julian Assange is partly to blame for his eviction?
Julian was my house guest for 13 months, so I know what he's like. And I'm afraid I'm not going to side with the Ecuadorians on this one. You know, they gave him asylum. So I feel what they're trying to do by this is justify the fact that they withdrawn asylum for somebody, which is illegal under an international law. So, you know, I do feel that this is the Ecuadorians trying to excuse their behavior on this one.
I know this is not the most important part of this story, but I am very interested what life was like over the last 7 years or so for Julian Assange living inside the Ecuadorian embassy. Well, what did he do?
Well, there's not much to do. I mean, it's imagine living in one or two small rooms in a London flat where you can hear the world outside but can't participate. Imagine being too worried about surveillance, you wouldn't even open a window. The thing that I think caused him most distress was the solitude. Now, what happened was he invited me once to come and see him on a Friday evening. And I wondered why it was a Friday, because I wanted it on a Thursday. And I noticed the embassy get quieter as people left to go home. I could see his face change. And I realized then what this sort of solitude meant for somebody. So, look, I think it was very, very difficult, certainly worse than prison. A prison has a regime where you're normally expected to get some medical help. He could only have a doctor or a dentist that could carry whatever they needed in, because the British government wouldn't let him have access to anything.
You're saying it was worse than prison?
Yes, on one level. But at the same time, I think it's important to note that Julian wanted to maintain the asylum. But yes, it was less comfortable than a prison.
Can you describe his level of involvement with WikiLeaks while he was living there?
Yeah. I mean, during the first 6 years, he was clearly running WikiLeaks, had a good internet access. He was able to do it. It was very few people, very small budget, and it was able to deliver a great impact. But in the last year, when he lost the internet access, he wasn't able to sustain that. So he doesn't run WikiLeaks, and he hasn't run WikiLeaks for some time now.
Look, he has many supporters, you among them, but he also has many critics, including news organizations like The Washington Post. The paper's editorial board said yesterday that he is not a press hero, that he violated journalistic standards because he didn't vet the information that he released and now allegedly used illegal methods to get it. What's your response to that?
Well, I think there are some inaccuracies in that. First of all, he has a different view to us. We in the trade as journalists are quite strict about redactions on things like this. And I believe that's right. The reason that the files were released unredacted was actually a product of US government pressure and somebody who stole them from him and released them by mistake. So it wasn't deliberately done. So I just think that's a slight inaccuracy. But it's not unfair to say that, you know, there's a debate about redactions. And that he is on a scale, but it is wrong to present him like that. The other point you make, the hacking. Well, I mean, that's very interesting, because obviously this needs to be tested in court. And I don't think that a newspaper should judge this before it has been tested in court. But however, my understanding is that what Julian allegedly did, because I don't know, I wasn't there, was actually support Manning in not being traced, i.e. protected his source. Obviously, these things might seem quite similar, but the fine line between them might be very relevant in this case.
He is now in a serious legal battle. What are his next steps, legally speaking, and what are his supporters' next moves?
Well, his next step, obviously, he's in a British prison now. I understand it's Belmarsh Prison. And it looks like the American extradition thing will come into force. And that will lead its course. But it could take up to 3 to 5 years. I mean, Britain does have very weak extradition laws with the states. So we are inclined to send people to states rather liberally. And America doesn't necessarily return them under the same jurisdiction.
Is he afraid of that? How afraid is he of extradition?
Oh, hugely. He absolutely fears going to America. He thinks this is about vengeance. And I can see why he thinks that, because, you know, America does have a record of not forgiving people. And actually, it's quite normal for powers. I mean, you know, when Britain was a superpower, we used to send gunboats if anybody annoyed a Britishman, you know, abroad. You know, Russia, it goes to Salisbury and it tries to kill people or poison them who it wants to make an example of. I'm not obviously wanting to directly compare America with Russia, because America doesn't kill people. But what it does seem to do, and this is what Julian's fear is that what America wants to do is dissuade others in a vengeful way by making an example of him and putting him in prison for life.
That's Vaughn Smith, a journalist and a friend to Julian Assange. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
This has been a historic week in Sudan. The military ousted the man who's been president for 30 years, Omar al-Bashir. Bashir is accused of war crimes and genocide. The country's defense minister will be in charge for the next 2 years. Angry protesters are still rallying and demanding a civilian-led government. Nada Fadl was born in Sudan. She lives in Omaha, Nebraska. She's interim membership and communications director for the Association of Sudanese American Professors in America. Nada, how has your family that's still in Sudan suffered, if at all, under the rule of President al-Bashir?
My dad personally had his own business that was thriving prior to al-Bashir's government, and he's been bombarded by significant taxes and his inability to get things done, because if you're not part of this government and if you're not loyal to them, it's really hard for you to get anything done in the government offices. Other family members have been active in their opposition to the regime, and they suffered from detainment. But overall, the whole country, including my family, has suffered from the economic crisis that's ongoing now in Sudan and the severe inflation and the increase in the prices of all commodities.
So what is life like there now? I assume that you're in touch very much with your family that's there. You have a significant family there still in Sudan. What are they saying about the most recent pressures on them?
Most families in Sudan now are relying on their relatives who live abroad, like myself, to send them aid in the form of money so that they can keep up with inflation in the country. However, the main issue that's been going on is there is just severe oppression, and that's just impacted everyone.
And that's why there was such a sense of optimism among protesters in Sudan, as well as you and other family members in Omaha, who thought that this was the end of the old regime and the start of a civilian-led leadership in Sudan. That's not the case, though. So the fact that apparently one of the associates of Mr. Bashir is going to be taking over, at least for now, it's going to be military control for about 2 years. What's your reaction to that?
So this, like you just stated, has been a mixed reaction. And the majority of Sudanese, whether in Sudan or abroad, have completely opposed the military coup that took over, mainly because this is basically another face to al-Bashir's regime, now repackaged and reproduced in a different form.
So it's kind of like new boss, same as the old boss. And the new boss, tell us about him.
Yeah, so the new boss, who's Awad ibn Auf, he was the Minister of Defense and was recently appointed by President al-Bashir after he restructured his cabinet. So he does not really hold a good record when it comes to human rights. So the protesters completely rejected him. The Sudanese Professional Association, which has been the orchestrator of these protests since December 19th, issued several statements asking the protesters to continue their position in front of the headquarters of the military and not get fooled by this apparent military coup.
You are so far away from Sudan, even though I know that you feel very integrated in what's happening right now. Aside from sending money to family members, what is the one thing you think that you and other Sudanese in the United States can do of consequence that could make a difference from this distance?
I think the most important thing would be raising awareness and advocating against the human rights violations that are happening in Sudan. And these have been done so far by multiple Sudanese all over the country, by sending letters to the representatives, asking for Congress and other government organizations to put a pressure on al-Bashir's government. There are multiple other organizations, such as the Association of Sudanese American Professors in America, that I'm part of, and we declared our commitment to rebuilding once a democratic regime is achieved in Sudan. This is not the first dictatorship that the Sudanese people were able to overthrow, and I'm very confident in the youth and the women who became the icon of this revolution, that they're able to make a change and help Sudan achieve a democracy again.
Nada Fadl of the Association of Sudanese American Professors in America, speaking with us from Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
The legendary Grammy Award-winning T-Bone Burnett is out with a new album, and it is dark.
He drew back the curtain, saw there was no earth, nor was there a universe. There was only light and the sound of mercy.
The Invisible Light, Acoustic Space is a departure for an artist who's worked most of his career behind the scenes as a producer for the industry's biggest stars. He produced the soundtrack for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? He won an Oscar for his work with Jeff Bridges in Crazy Heart. And he made the music for the TV shows Nashville and True Detective. But fans will hardly recognize the electronic trance that rumbles through his first new album in 11 years. T-Bone Burnett, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Happy to speak with you.
Well, and it's a pleasure, but I have to say, after I spent some time listening to this album, I'm a little bit worried about you. It is very dark, isn't it?
It sounds dark, but no, I'm in pretty good shape. It's called The Invisible Light because there is, inside of all this darkness, there is light. You just have to listen into it.
Okay, well, let's start talking about the music, because you definitely are taking your audience on a journey. We're going to listen to Man Without a Country, where at times it feels like a trip through the underworld.
I've always been a man without a country. I've always been a citizen of heaven.
And other times, it felt as if you're sitting next to a priest celebrating Mass.
Heavenly desensitized. Saboteur, criminal.
Tell me what you're trying to do here, T-Bone Burnett.
I suppose what I'm doing is, rather than write a memoir or, you know, try to put down all of this experience I've had, I'm creating a receptacle for my 50 years of gathering knowledge, and especially about the areas of behavioral modification and condition responses and the electronic media. So this is what I'm doing, really. I'm talking about these things I've learned and of a 50-year study. I'm 71 years old now, so show business has nothing left for me. I don't need anything from life anymore, so I'm just going to put back out everything I've learned in this way.
And you're doing it in a very unique way. Let's listen to another track. This is called Being There.
Being there while not being there, here and nowhere. Now the mask is off, the cocktail Molotov, the Philistines only scoff.
Why are you using this style, this spoken word singing? It's all throughout the album.
Well, you know, I still consider myself part of the beat generation, and I fell in love with beat poetry when at the same time in the 1960s. And then I've loved hip-hop music since the 70s when it started in earnest. And I've always used spoken word in my records. You know, I think every record I've ever done has had some spoken word in it.
But this is almost in its entirety.
Yeah, there are melodies here and there. But I feel like, you know, I don't feel the need to write songs. In fact, I'm not sure I don't want to write songs necessarily right now. I just want to get this knowledge out in the cleanest, purest way I can. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to lull people into a melody at the moment.
You mentioned that there is hope to this album, and I want to play this 7-second track called Itopia Chant. Here it is.
We want you to know you can learn anything we want you to know.
That's, by the way, that's Cassandra Wilson chanting that. So the whole chant is, we want you to know you can learn anything we want you to know. You can learn anything we want you to know. And that's going to recur all the way through all of these editions that come out.
That was the happiest takeaway from the album, if you ask me.
Well, it's all, I feel that there's mirth in that. There's danger and threat in it, but there's mirth in it, too, because we have to laugh at the devil.
All of this is so different than what many people know you for the country and roots music that has been a part of your career. How is it that you're comfortable shifting through these ideas and these genres where most musicians wouldn't be going here? I mean, right?
Well, you know, of course, I actually started out in experimental music in the 1960s. I was lucky enough to get access to a studio, and I started playing with electronic music and sampling, and it was all done on tape in those days, but we still sampled and turned things around and distorted things and turned things upside down. And I've actually been doing this my whole life. At the same time, one of my closest friends was a guy named Stephen Bruton, who was a great bluegrass musician, and I fell in love with folk music and Ralph Stanley and the Stanley Brothers. And so all of this stuff is a part of what I've been doing the whole time. And I view, you know, as soon as you put a microphone in front of any instrument, a piano or a violin or a guitar, it becomes an electronic instrument. You know, so I've only been dealing with electronic music. I wanted to be behind the scenes making records in the studio, and that's where I've been most comfortable, and that's where I've lived my life.
Absolutely. In fact, you have worked with some of the biggest names in music behind the scenes: Elton John, Elvis Costello, Robert Plant, Alison Krauss. Our own Robin Young spoke with Sarah Bareilles recently about her new album, and Sarah told us that you helped her overcome her fear of recording with other musicians. Let's listen to some of that.
I have some real timidity as a piano player, and I worry about making mistakes. And one of the great gifts of working with T-Bone Burnett is that he's really not about perfection at all. He's all about capturing a moment. So he really encouraged me to make music with the band, and it's the first time I've ever done that.
What do you think?
Perfection is a second-rate idea. There is no perfection, and striving for it is a waste of time. And it's part of pandering. It's like, what does an eraser mean? Like, when you erase something, does it erase some part of yourself that's not good enough?
No, so, I totally agree. I think about that on the radio all the time. I mean, I, you know, you have to sort of just allow yourself to make your mistakes and move on and realize that you're not perfect.
That's right. And that's even more beautiful. You know, the universe is not perfect. The solar system, when you first hear about the solar system, you think there's some order to it, the planets and the orbits and all that. And if you look at it, it's all kapotsky. It's all scattered out all over everything.
Well, so. I don't know what you're going to say is imperfect about this next song, because I think it's pretty close. You won an Academy Award. Along with Ryan Bingham, who is singing The Weary Kind from the film Crazy Heart here.
And this ain't no place for the weary kind. And this ain't no place to lose your mind.
I had to have an excuse to play that song. I love it.
I love that song too. I love that song. It's a beautiful song. I wanted to call that movie The Weary Kind. You know, I thought, I said to Scott Cooper, the writer and the director, that after we wrote that song, I said, you know, this movie should be called Weary Kind. And he said, oh, I don't know. And he hemmed and hawed, and we didn't change it. And then last year he came to me, he said, you know, we should have called that movie The Weary
Really?
Kind. Yeah, it's a great title. It sounds like a great classic movie.
Well, it did pretty well with Crazy Heart. But, you know, what are your thoughts on the state of country music today?
I think country music is changing. I think there's a new establishment being created with Chris Stapleton and Sturgill Simpson and Casey Musgrave. And I think we've been through a time, like Steve Earle said, modern country music is hip hop for people that are afraid of black people. You know? And I think there's absolute truth in that. And I think country music for a decade has been pandering.
How so?
The songs are about the same thing. It's a, what do they call it, identity politics or something like that,
where
it's about trucks and blue jeans and beer and that stuff. And that's identity politics right there. It's all about this false notion of who we are as Americans. And this is what I think we all have to grapple with. Our cultural inheritance is important to all of us, but we're behaving in a way right now that will destroy our cultural inheritance unless we're smarter than we're being.
Which brings us back to the album that you've just created, even though it is so different than some of the work you've done in the past. Here's another track from Invisible Light Acoustic Space. It's called Beat the Devil.
I'll tell you what you want to hear, then I'll do what I want to do. I'll tell you what you want to hear, then I'll do what I want to do. I'll play upon your darkest fear, I'll be a savant for you.
Just final thoughts on this album, T-Bone Burnett. I know it's the first of three, but what after that?
You know, actually, I don't know if it's going to be three. There are three editions we've already recorded. There may be several editions after that. I'm not quite sure. I'm just going to continue to put down everything I've learned and my experience in this form until I stop.
T-Bone Burnett, the new album is Invisible Light Acoustic Space. It was a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Great to speak with you, Peter.
Be able to see through a guise and all the trouble he will devise.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave, control your comfort.
On the verge of going public, Uber has issued a warning to potential investors. The company may never make a profit. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, welcome. We're just a few weeks from Uber shares going up for sale. It's one of the most anticipated IPOs of the year. Is it normal that a company would issue a warning like that?
Well, theoretically, Uber actually did have a profit last year, but it was because they sold a stake in some overseas businesses. If you exclude that, they lost about $3 billion. And no, it's not that uncommon for companies to go public on the stock market while still posting losses. But that $3 billion number is pretty big. It's unusual to be losing that much money and go public. But that warning they gave is really sort of one of the things you have to lay out in these filings to the SEC. It's sort of the worst case scenario.
Right.
Certainly people expect them to be profitable down the road.
It's still a huge IPO, valuing the company at about $100 billion. But, Mike, that's down from previous valuations in large part because of what happened with Lyft's IPO.
Yeah, right. And Lyft, a lot of excitement about that IPO, but the stock has fallen about $20 from its IPO price. So there's kind of two ways to look at it. One is that investors are seeing Uber coming down the pipeline and not as excited for Lyft as they were. So what happens next is Uber basically goes on what's called a roadshow, where the managers and their investment bankers try to sell this stock to mutual fund and hedge fund managers and pension funds. And I suspect what they'll try to do is differentiate themselves from Lyft and show that they're a more diverse company, you know, with Uber Eats and their ambition to be sort of in the freight business and their ambition to really be a leader in self-driving cars and that sort of thing.
The last time that Wall Street had this many money-losing tech companies in the midst of an IPO was back in 1999 and 2000, right before the dot-com bubble burst. We've talked about this before, Mike. Just another symbol, a sign of potential concern that people might have?
It's certainly raising some concern. You know, people call it quote-unquote late cycle, meaning that, you know, this bull market in stocks and this economic expansion has been going on a long time, and these things never last forever. And if you look at the total amount of IPOs that are expected to be sold on Wall Street this year, its estimates are roughly $100 billion, which does match sort of the biggest years we've seen, 1999 being one of them, 2007. But as a percentage of the stock market currently, because remember, the stock market is much, much higher than it was in 2000. As a percentage of the stock market currently, it's barely a blip. So from that perspective, it's maybe not as alarming as just the raw number, $100 billion.
And I think it's important to point out that Amazon never used to make money. They went public back in 1997. They were losing cash. They lost cash for a long time. Now look at Amazon. So, you know, there is a way out of this. It's not entirely bad news, briefly, Mike.
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of the story that Uber would like to tell, is that they're investing heavily in future growth and their sales are growing strongly. So, you know, to them, hopefully it's just a matter of time before those profits start rolling in.
Okay, Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Lawyers from the city of Chicago are going after the actor Jussie Smollett in civil court. This comes just weeks after an Illinois state prosecutor dropped all felony charges against him. The complaint lawyers filed yesterday says Chicago detectives worked 1,836 hours investigating the alleged hate crime that Smollett reported back in January. Police concluded the incident was a hoax. The overtime amounts to more than $130,000. So far, Smollett has refused to pay it. Here's Chicago's Mayor Rahm Emanuel at a press conference last month. He told reporters then that Smollett should pay up.
Given that he doesn't feel any sense of contrition and remorse, my recommendation is when he writes the check, in the memo section, he can put the word, I'm accountable for the hoax.
Mayor Emanuel says he doesn't know why prosecutors dropped the criminal charges against Smollett and called it a whitewash of justice. Meanwhile, Jussie Smollett continues to maintain his innocence. He says he was the victim of an attack motivated by racism and homophobia. He spoke after the charges were dropped.
This has been an incredibly difficult time, honestly one of the worst of my entire life. But I am a man of faith, and I am a man that has knowledge of my history, and I would not bring my family, our lives, or the movement through a fire like this. I just wouldn't.
Jussie Smollett's attorneys say they'll mount a vigorous defense and that the city of Chicago owes the actor an apology for dragging his reputation through the mud.
Well, nearly a decade ago, lawmakers in Illinois said yes to a sweeping expansion of legal gambling. It's brought tens of thousands of new video gambling machines to Illinois. But politicians also promised to help people who become addicted to using those machines. And apparently that has not happened. An investigation by ProPublica Illinois and member station WBEZ in Chicago found the amount of money spent on gambling addiction treatment has actually gone way down. WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos has the story.
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change.
Three times each week, about 15 or 20 people get together in a red brick office building on Main Street in Downers Grove.
In this room, this is a safe place because everybody understands, because we're all addicts.
I am a compulsive gambler. I lost my mortgage payment, and I had to tell my spouse.
This is Ann and Leon. As members of this Gamblers Anonymous group, they know what happens to people who cannot quit.
They'll either go insane, they will kill themselves, or they'll go to jail. A compulsive gambler, those are the three options unless we have recovery.
Anne's 58. Like others here, she asked us not to use her last name. Anne says she became a gambling addict after her husband died suddenly, and she placed those bad bets not at casinos, but at video gambling parlors, places in strip malls with names like Betty's and Stella's.
You know, these people that go to these places, these people that have this addiction are not some lowlife. These are your moms, your sisters, your brothers. People go there because it's convenient.
It's easier than ever to gamble here. The state legalized video gambling almost 10 years ago, and now there are more places to bet in Illinois than in any other state, even Nevada. Instead of having just 10 casinos in Illinois, there are nearly 7,000 places where you can place a bet today, with as many as 5 video gambling machines at each of those locations. That's what made Ann's addiction spiral out of control.
The casinos wasn't really a big thing for me, but it was the Betty's and the Stella's because it was easy access. I could be gone for an hour or two, and so I would lie about where I was or how much money I had or didn't have. There's just a lot of lying.
Chicago does not allow video gambling, but you can find the machines in 1,000 other towns across the state, including many suburbs and downstate communities. Remember the guy who gambled away his mortgage money? This is Leon again.
Those little gambling establishments in every corner now, in every restaurant, every gas station, every parking lot, every plaza. You walk out a loser and dwelling on your whole disease, which is gambling.
When they approved video gambling, lawmakers said Illinois would spend an extra $1.5 million every year to help people like Leon and Ann. But the politicians quietly changed the language in the law so they would not have to put more money toward gambling addiction after all. The state actually spends less now on helping addicts than it did before video gambling came online and vastly expanded the opportunities to bet in Illinois.
Because you have these machines coming up all over the place, you're going to have people that never thought they had an addiction all of a sudden having addictions, and there's nowhere for them to go. There's no help for them. There's no monies for them.
And state officials failed gambling addicts in another big way. Since they brought in video gambling, they have not put in a crucial safeguard that's helped many problem gamblers stay out of the casinos. Ann, Leon, and others in the Downers Grove group have placed themselves on what's called the casino self-exclusion list. Thousands of people with gambling addiction have voluntarily banned themselves from casinos. But if you're on the self-exclusion list and get caught sneaking back into the casinos, you'll get arrested. That's exactly what happened to Leon a few years ago. The 42-year-old business analyst says security guards nabbed him at the casino in Des Plaines.
They took me in the back room. They ridiculed me, embarrassed me, made me feel like a total loser. They called me an idiot. He said, what kind of idiot would come back knowing you did a self-exclusion? You think we weren't going to catch you?
Then they took Leon's jackpot.
$8,850.
Many gambling addicts say the fear of getting busted is what makes the self-exclusion option so effective. Leon even tried getting the video gambling companies to ban him from playing on their machines, too.
I called the corporate office, and I said, I'm a self-excluded gambler from the casinos. They're like, well, no, we don't do that. We don't have the same thing. Just don't come. I'm like, lady, tell a heroin addict not to put needles in his arm. They don't get it.
Leon and other addicts say state officials can show that they get it by creating a self-exclusion program for video gambling places. We found out regulators with the Illinois Gaming Board repeatedly have considered doing that. In internal memos dating as far back as 2014, the head of the casino self-exclusion program has told top officials that starting a similar program for video gambling, quote, would not present too many challenges for the gaming board. And officials privately acknowledged back then that video gambling would cause an increase in the number of compulsive problem gamblers in Illinois. So we asked Don Tracy, the chairman of the gaming board, why there's no self-exclusion for video gambling places.
We have explored the possibilities. We probably need to make it a higher priority.
But nothing's been done. In the internal memos we got, one state official said starting a self-exclusion program for video gambling would run into a, quote, lack of political fortitude on the part of elected officials facing growing budget deficits. In other words, the politicians are afraid of losing money from video gambling. But most of the money from video gambling actually goes to the industry and not to the state. And that industry is tight with Illinois lawmakers. Those days and nights, they went. I saw a stark example of just how close the industry and Illinois politicians are when I traveled to Las Vegas. There, during the annual gambling industry conference, The Illinois Video Gambling Trade Group treated a group of Springfield lawmakers to dinner at an expensive Italian restaurant. One investor in a video gambling company here arrived at the Las Vegas dinner in a Bentley. They would not let me into the restaurant, but outside, I recognized a man in a white Guayabera shirt.
Chairman Berrios. Dan Mihalopoulos from Chicago Public Media.
It was Joe Berrios. Until recently, Berrios was the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party and the Cook County Assessor. Now, he's working for the video gambling companies.
We're an industry that's running strong. People are playing the games and people are enjoying the games, and we're bringing a lot of money to the state.
As a new governor takes office and looks for new revenue, gambling industry interests are pushing for more video gambling and also sports betting and new casinos. But in all those gambling expansion proposals, there's no mention of providing more money to help people who are addicted to gambling. Umbrella sky. For Here and Now, I'm Dan Mihalopoulos in Chicago.
And Dan's reporting was done in partnership with Jason Grotto and Sandhya Kambumpati from ProPublica, Illinois.
This weekend will be bittersweet for fans of Game of Thrones as HBO launches the long-awaited eighth and final season. The first of the final episodes airs Sunday, wrapping up a story that has spanned 9 years with countless characters woven into a complex narrative. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans knows all about this television phenomenon. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So first of all, it's worth noting that in an era when we have so many choices, HBO has been attracting an average of more than 32 million viewers per episode in the United States alone. So this is a hugely popular show. It has spawned a squillion cultural references. But beyond that, do you think it's going to go down?
Is that a technical term?
Exactly. That's right. It's one of those Nielsen terms. But will it go down in the annals of TV history as an important TV show?
Oh, I think without a doubt. I mean, beyond the fact that it is drawing a level of viewership that very few TV shows get to at this day and age, especially on cable, especially on premium cable where people pay an extra amount of money to see it, it has brought epic movie-level filmmaking to television. Reportedly, the budgets per episode for that show have swelled from $5 million to something like $15 million an episode. And so they have brought together the worlds of filmmaking and television in a new way, and they've set a precedent for what is considered epic filmmaking on television that producers will be striving to meet and exceed, I think, for many years to come.
But is it sustainable? I mean, is this maybe why it's ending, because it costs so much to produce in the first place?
No, I think this is ending in part because a story this complex can only go on for so long. And we've seen this with a lot of sort of complex, serialized TV shows. They really can't go much beyond 5, 6, 7 seasons. And so it's interesting that there's still so much a love for the show now, so much excitement that it's coming back, even though it's been gone for a long time. I think HBO's ending it at just the right time. And the story's starting to get so complex that even the fans won't be able to follow it anymore. And that's when you know it's time to bring a series like this in for a landing.
So, as you said, it's been a while since the last episode of Game of Thrones. So tell us where the series is picking up from now.
That may be the toughest question you asked me today. It's a really complex story. But basically, overall, there's two big crises that are affecting this sort of Lord of the Rings kind of a world. One of them is that there's this huge zombie army of undead people that are coming down from the north to face and threaten everything that's living that we know in this universe. And in addition to that, you have all these warring families that are trying to get control of the Iron Throne, which is the royalty that rules this whole continent of Westeros.
So, as you said, it has a lot of subplots, meaning a lot of characters, some of whom are real favorites among audience members. And I wonder who you think audiences will look forward most to seeing for this final season, and even if they won't see them for too much longer.
Right. Kit Harington's character, Jon Snow, the character that we heard in the previous clip, might be a lot of people's favorite. He's been sort of positioned as the hero of the series. When we met him when the series started, he seemed very humble, someone who was the illegitimate son and not destined to be anywhere near being royalty or being on the throne. Now we've learned that he's actually the product of a secret marriage between two people who had the strongest claim on the throne. So he has the strongest claim on the throne. We don't know how he's going to react if and when he finds out about this in the final season. There's lots of great sort of soldier characters that I love. They're the working stiffs of Game of Thrones. They're the guys who just, want to get out there and make a little money and make it home at the end of their shift, as it were. And there's one character named Bronn, who I like a lot, who fits that bill. But I suspect a lot of people would say that Peter Dinklage's character, Tyrion Lannister, might be their favorite. He's the wittiest character. He's the smartest character. He's also the most sympathetic. He's a little person who's sort of the outcast son of the richest family in the realm, and they're the ones who sit on the throne right now, and he's actually been in conflict and at war with them throughout much of the series. He's also very rueful about how everyone in that very macho, very athletic, physical world makes fun of him for his height, and he has a little bit where he talks about what it's like to have people crack jokes about your height when you're a little person in that world, and we have a clip, so let's check it out.
Everyone who makes a joke about a dwarf's height thinks he's the only person ever to make a joke about a dwarf's height. The height of nobility, a man of your stature, someone to look up to. You're all making the same five or six jokes.
It was a long time ago.
It was. And how have things been going for you since then?
So people who joke about him in that way, they tend to get their comeuppance. So it'll be good to see what if that pans out in the final season.
And Peter Dinklage, even if Game of Thrones is coming to an end, he always ends up doing something interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's an amazing actor, and he's been able to show it in so many ways on this show.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, our big star on this show. Thank you so much, Eric. Nice to talk to you.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, but boy, do I wish I were Peter Dinklage. This is Here and Now.